welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. When was the last time you went to the zoo? Well, if it was in Connecticut, it had to have been in Bridgeport, because Bridgeport is the only accredited zoo in the state of Connecticut, and wait until you hear about all the great things it does. Our guest for today's episode is the man who's been the director of Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo for the last 40 years, Greg Dancho. Greg's list of accomplishments at the zoo is lengthy, and he's going to be along in just a moment to tell us about how this gem of an institution came to be in the park city of Bridgeport. This week's trivia question: this Connecticut resident wrote one of the most famous books ever, and not accidentally. He led the way in bringing copyright law to the U.S. to protect such writings. Who was he? Stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. When people need the best quality health care, there's a reason they turn to Yale New Haven Health. In 1826, Yale New Haven Hospital became Connecticut's very first hospital. They were the first hospital in the U.S. to use chemotherapy. Yale New Haven was the first to introduce insulin pumps for diabetic patients. And they introduced the world's first intensive care unit for newborns. For more information about Yale New Haven Health, visit YNHHS.org. That's YNHHS.org. The history of zoos in Connecticut is pretty quick to tell you about. There used to be five, now there's one. Bridgeport is home to Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo. Now, it used to be called the Beardsley Park Zoo, and that was back when the city of Bridgeport owned it and financed its operation. But as you may have known, the city of Bridgeport had some pretty steep financial difficulties, and the operating budget for the zoo never exceeded $1 million. Now, today, the budget's $6.5 million, and the owner, as you'll hear, is an organization very much devoted to zoos. All the proceeds are pumped back into the zoo, allowing for some rather impressive improvements. Now, there are a couple of places in the state where animals are kept and could be visited, petting zoos, alpaca farms, and the like, but they're not accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. That's the official body in the U.S. that confers that status. Now, to get accreditation, there are four things you have to be able to show. Number one, you've got to do educational programs. What does your zoo do? Why do they do it? Why are the animals and the environment important? Number two, you have to be actively working towards conservation. So you have to work with endangered species and help the environments. Number three, you have to show that you've attained verifiable guest satisfaction. Because the zoo's recreational purpose, that is, giving people from all walks of life a meaningful and fun experience, is actually part of the accreditation process. Number four, you have to be doing research on animals. Well, Bridgeport has checked all four of those boxes more than adequately. A quick summary of the zoo: it celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2022. They have 350 animals in all, representing 75 species. Now, a good number of those species are highly endangered, and zoo employees are working to increase their numbers in ways you'll hear about. The largest greenhouse in Connecticut is located there, and one of the last of the carousels is there. And it also has a display of antique horses from a historic carousel at Pleasant Beach Amusement Park in Bridgeport that went defunct decades ago. Well, our guest today is the longtime Connecticut Beardsley Zoo director, Greg Dancho. He used to spend his summers as a child at the zoo, looking at the animals on Sunday afternoons with his seven siblings, and then, as he told me, having his mother drive them all home to watch an episode of The Bowery Boys, if you remember that program. Well, we begin the discussion today talking about James Beardsley. Yes, Beardsley Zoo, Beardsley Park, the man who made it all happen back in the 1800s. At the end of the program today, I'm going to share the very sad story of what happened to James Beardsley after all he did for the city of Bridgeport. First, though, Greg Dancho. I want to go back and ask you to take the time capsule all the way back to the very beginning and talk a little bit about the guy Beardsley, James Beardsley. And what I understand is that he was born early 1800s or so in Monroe to a cattle farming family. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, it was a cattle farming family, but it really was more of, he was a broker. So most of his cattle were out in the Midwest, and he kind of just kept his operations, business operations around here. Back when, you know, he was living in the area, Bridgeport was, you know, we call it the nitty gritty. The people that usually use that term for Bridgeport back then, the nitty gritty city. Most of the munitions were done in Bridgeport. So really it had a very industrial feel to the area. And so when Beardsley was looking to support the city, he was looking to maybe donate some land to get some people to come up to the farm area. I always thought it was kind of funny because from downtown Bridgeport to Beardsley Park is about 2.5 miles. But back then, 2.5 miles was going from the city out to the country. But he donated some land to the city of Bridgeport. And then over time, he donated a little bit more land. And then other families got involved. So when other people, because they saw donations, they said, well, let's all donate more land to the city. Property then went up to about 180 acres. To get to Beardsley Park, Noble Avenue really didn't exist. Noble Avenue comes from downtown Bridgeport straight up into Beardsley Park. He worked with John Noble, and they worked together to purchase land from downtown Bridgeport up to the park. And then working with John Noble, they were able to get a horse-drawn trolleys that brought people from downtown Bridgeport up into the park itself. As you drive into our parking lot, to the left-hand side, we still have the barns that held the trolleys and held the horses that brought the people from downtown Bridgeport up here.
He did, though, put a condition on the land, right, that the city shall accept and keep the same forever as a public park?
The deed restrictions were in place that you could not take Beardsley Park and make anything else out of it. It actually had a par-3 golf course here. You can actually see, drive around the park, and you'll see areas where they had elevated tees. It became more of a passive park with some ball fields and some tennis courts. One of ice used to be an ice house, and they actually farmed ice out of the pond during the wintertime to be used in ice boxes around the city of Bridgeport.
Now, when you talk about legacy, the name Frederick Law Olmsted was prime name for developing parks, right? Central Park in New York City, Seaside Park in Bridgeport. And the city brought him in to do also Beardsley Park, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And really, you have to almost go back to Barnum also, because Barnum plays a big part in the zoo and in Beardsley Park. Because P.T. Barnum, everybody knows P.T. Barnum. What's what they know about? He's the circus guy. But he was also the mayor of Bridgeport. And becoming the mayor of Bridgeport, he started looking at the idea of doing urban parks, because urban parks were not really existent. He almost could be called the father of urban parks, to where he started looking at areas that he needed for people that lived in the city to get out and get away from, you know, their work every day. They brought in Frederick Law Olmsted for Beardsley Park. His ideas were to have open space for people to be able to congregate, like the Great Meadow in Central Park, which people know about, right? But if you go through Beardsley Park, you see these big open areas that he designed so people can get out and be together, you know, and have a picnics and family gatherings. The other side was he wanted areas where people can go out into a wooded area, into paths and trails, so they can commune with nature. So that was really the couple of things that Frederick Law Olmsted really brought into his design. And you could see that in Beardsley Park.
So now, if you can put your minds back into the late 1880s, and you've got an aging P.T. Barnum with his circus bringing his animals like zebras and camels and elephants over to the park to exercise them, and, you know, and during the winter when they were off the road and doing all this, and it's just an impressive, you know, concept to think about what Bridgeport looked like back then.
Well, it's very interesting because people may not realize that in Bridgeport, that's where P.T. Barnum wintered their circus, because the train was right there, and they wintered right down in a park down off of 95. If you're heading into New York, as you just pass the major part of the city and you look off to the right-hand side, that's Went Field. Now, Went Field is where P.T. Barnum would winter the circus down there. And because it was not that far away, they'd bring some of the animals up, because there was nothing down there. It was just a lot. But the only place that was close enough was Beardsley Park. They could walk some of the animals up here. So they walk camels up here. Sometimes elephants would get walked up here. We are an accredited member of AZA, which is Association of Zoos and Aquariums. In that organization, there are different groups that work with different species. And there's a species survival plan, which is really interesting to me. I got a call from the species survival plan folks on giraffe. And they said, you're on record at Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo to be the first zoo in the country to have a giraffe born. And they said, wow, that's really cool, except we never had giraffe here. So it turns out that the giraffe was actually born to the circus. And because it was in Bridgeport, they put that on our records as the zoo. Not only that, would people see the animals up here, and that got Wesley Hayes, who was a park commissioner, excited about. That's how he got excited about the zoo, because he would see people looking at the animals coming up here and looking at the park. And he said, well, that's a cool idea. Let's think about putting a zoo here. Frederick Law Olmsted never put zoos in any of his parks. It was never part of his plan. Back then, every major city had a zoo. A lot of cities, when they looked at things they wanted to do for their citizens, they looked at zoos because of places to go for recreation.
At the point of the opening of the doors for the zoo in 1922, what it started off as, which some people I think still remember this, was a drive-through zoo, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. When you go to the zoo today and you walk through the zoo, you may notice how wide the pathways are. These were city streets. Beardsley Park had city streets in it, and the zoo was in the center of the park. And by being in the center of the park, it was part of the city street structure. So that's why the roadways in the zoo, most of them, are 32 feet wide, which are a standard city street width. My family would come up to the zoo on Sundays. We drive right into the center of the zoo, drive and park in the parking lot in the middle of the zoo, go see the animals. This is the place to go. Didn't cost anything back then. And we could all get out there, and my mother could let us run around and get tired. The zoo actually had a very open feel back then because you could drive right in. Now, that did not make a very safe facility either, you know, because every time we had to walk across the street, I had to hold my mother's hand because just go see the animals because you're afraid a car would hit you. A perimeter fence was put on the zoo just to protect the animals and make sure they were safe, putting gates on the zoo. So the zoo actually shut down at 4:30 instead of back then. If you wanted to come up visit the zoo, you can come up anytime during the day or night because it was open. There was nothing to keep you from coming up.
So let's talk about Greg Dantcho for a second. Now, you may have watched the Bowery Boys on Sunday afternoon after coming home from the park, but you also used to go out and, as I understand it, collect snakes and frogs.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate. We had 7 acres of land, which was 2 miles from the zoo. Every day when I came home from school, I would go out into the woods. And back then, my dream was to become a herpetologist. And a herpetologist is somebody who works with snakes, turtles, lizards, amphibians, frogs, so the whole gamut of the cold-blooded species. I would collect those animals. My mother was not a fan of snakes. She was actually very afraid of them. However, she kind of said, hey, this is something you wanted to do. You can do this. So one of the things I used to do was go around on junk day. Some people may not remember when TVs had tubes in them, these big tubes, and they were in these big furniture cabinets. What I would do is I'd find a TV that was on the side of the curb. I'd get it. I'd bring it home. I'd take the guts out of it, take the tube out of it, put a piece of glass in the front, put a door on the back, and that was one of my snake habitats that I would build. And my mother thought that was not cool, but she let me have those. I never told my mother really when the snakes got away. That was something I was not going to tell her that, oh, by the way, Ma, one of the garter snakes that I picked out in the yard is no longer in the tank. I would just have to go grab another one real quick and put it in there. So if she came by, she would think there still was one there.
Do you ever have any animals escape at the zoo?
We've had animals get out, but not escape. One of the more memorable ones I've had was when we had a storm that came through and one of our pine trees fell down and took the fence out on our wolf enclosure, wolf habitat. And I remember sitting in my office at the time, my office up in the zoo. I looked out the window when the tree came down. I watched the wolves come out on the tree. They actually walked on the tree out of the enclosure, looked around, turned around, went right back in again. Because this is where their home was. They were not going to go anyplace. So we were able to go in and secure them in their night quarters. I remember one real memorable day. Before, remember, we talked about we still drive in the zoo and park in here. I came in early in the morning and I drove in. It was cold, just fall. And I remember opening the gates and coming in, driving up into the zoo to get ready for the day. I was the first one in and I came around the corner and I saw an entire bison herd standing in the roadway, which was really impressive because it was cold morning, so their breath was steaming out of their nose, and they're all standing together looking at me. And I stopped for a second. Well, That is a great, what a great sight that is. Look how beautiful they look. Until I panicked and turned around, went back and locked the gate to make sure they didn't get out into the park. And then again, walked in, grabbed a bucket of feed. Staff came in, grabbed a bucket of feed. We walked them right back in, then went back to an enclosure, no problem at all. So over time, we've had some animals that have taken a little vacation, but normally we have not had any major issues.
So I want to just blow a little smoke in your direction right now because in 1975, you started volunteering for the zoo. In 1980, you became what they call zookeeper. But in 1983, at the ripe young age of 25, you became the acting zoo director. And the thing that I find most remarkable is that here you are in your 20s, and you managed to get full accreditation for the zoo from the American Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And this is an honor and a distinction that only 240 zoos and aquariums have achieved nationwide. And you did that as acting director in your 20s and then became zoo director the following year in 1988. That's very impressive.
Well, I thank you so much. But that definitely was a team effort, and was interesting when I became the acting director back then, back in 1983. I went to the then mayor, and he had just been elected. And I went to him and said, "Mayor Paoletta, I just became the acting director at the zoo. I'm really excited. What plans do we have for the zoo? What do you think?" And he was like, "I don't know." And so we kind of looked at each other and went, "Okay." So we really had a pathway to go here, and that was more most interesting thing about the zoo back then. We had a path to take. The path we take was: is the zoo going to move forward, or is the zoo going to be like the other zoos in the state of Connecticut? That one was in Hartford, one was in New London. There was, like I said, five zoos in the state of Connecticut. They all went away. We decided that we're going to try to see if we can keep the zoo moving. And we're really fortunate to be able to get funding from the state of Connecticut for the first time to do a major renovation to some of our very old exhibits that really were deteriorating. And that was followed up with some more funding. And then we started our educational programs. And we're really proud that we were able to gain accreditation and keep accreditation for these many years. One of the things that with an analogy you can use for working here at the zoo is that really this is like a city. You know, we have health issues. We have to work with guests, people coming into our area. We have residents, constituents we have to work with. We have education programs. We have food. So really, when you look at it, it's like a small microcosm of working with a city.
So in 1995, while the city still owned it, they built this carousel building. Can you tell us about that?
Way back when Mayor Madonese was the mayor of Bridgeport, I remember him coming to the zoo and looking out on what we call Lookout Point, which is right where the carousel exists right now, standing there and going, "I want to bring the Pleasure Beach Carousel," which Pleasure Beach was a park down in Bridgeport, which had an amusement park on it. A carousel was there, but it was defunct and people hadn't gotten out of it for many years. And he said to me, "What I want to do is get a sky crane from Sikorsky and pick the entire carousel unit up, bring it down Long Island Sound, bring it up the Pequannock River, and then set it right here on top of what we call Lookout Point. I'd like to get the carousel working again." Now, that was Madonese. That was probably 15, 20 years before the carousel actually got to be at the zoo. In the meantime, the horses were all taken from the ride, taken out to be restored, but there was no place to put them. So at some point, there was a talk about selling the horses to make money for the zoo because the horses were antique and they're all wood carved. That got people very upset. So the decision was made to put a working carousel up at the zoo, but not put the old horses on the ride because of the wear and tear that they would have. So that created a kind of a carousel museum here at the zoo, where we had a working carousel put in the center of the building. And the antique horses, which were Carmel and Illions, which are a famous make of carver that made these horses, on display there. We made it big enough so we could have birthday parties and we could have weddings and we could have meetings. And really, that was a huge addition to the zoo. And I got to say, probably 80% of the people that visit the zoo ride the carousel.
One of the most important or really significant steps from the zoo occurred in 1997 with the sale of the zoo. Why don't you explain what was behind the sale of the zoo?
The sale of the zoo was money. The city of Bridgeport was in pretty much a large debt. The governor of the state of Connecticut was Lowell Weicker. Joe Ganim was the mayor. and I'm paraphrasing here, the mayor went up to Hartford and said, the city could use some money. Is there anything the state would like to purchase from us? We have a golf course. We have beaches. We have an airport. We have a zoo. Again, very much paraphrasing. Governor Weicker said, oh, I love the zoo. I went to the zoo years ago. I remember the elephant at the zoo. I'll buy the zoo and the park from you. So the deals were started. Bill Weicker lost the election. Governor Rowland came in. And Governor Rowland, again, paraphrasing, I have no use for owning a zoo. I don't really want a zoo or a park. The state's in fiscal problems too. I don't really want this, but I'm going to still uphold the agreement, but I don't want to be a part of this. And so the Connecticut Zoological Society was approached, which was our support group for the zoo, who ran their concessions here at the zoo. They were approached and said, okay, would you want to purchase and run the zoo? Selling the zoo to a private organization may constitute the deed restriction being triggered. That went through the courts. It was a long, drawn-out process through the courts. And then finally, all the T's were crossed, the I's were dotted, and the zoo was transferred to the Connecticut Zoological Society. And so the Connecticut Zoological Society owns and operates the zoo. We went from 33 acres of land to 54 acres of land, so that we did add more property to the zoo for future expansion. And the state of Connecticut actually owns the park, and the city of Bridgeport has an agreement with them. So the park is run by the city of Bridgeport, but it's actually Beardsley Park is a state park right now.
You look at your 350 animals, 75 species. What are some of the more fun animals?
Well, you expect, as we talked about a little while ago, that I was a herpetologist. I love snakes and reptiles and all that kind of stuff. However, I really started looking at working with other animals, and right now, my favorite animal, and right now, actually, you can't even see it right now here at the zoo, I hate to say, but as our tigers. We have had tigers for many, many years. Our logo is our tiger. I had our first tiger born ever here at the zoo in Connecticut while I was working with them. And now we are in the process of building a whole new tiger habitat. So we moved our tigers out. We're going to start seeing construction of a $4 million tiger habitat that hopefully will be completed in a few years and bring our tigers back. One of the things we want to do here is help with the animals on the planet, keeping these animals on the planet. So having these really tremendously endangered species and working within not just keeping them here for people to see, but keeping them alive and keeping them healthy, and then actually having offspring to be able to get them potentially back to where they came from is what our dreams are. When people think about zoos, they think of it as captive. No, we want to see these animals back to where they belong. However, we kind of know that those pressures that are out there are not going away. So we have to be the safe keepers. We have to keep these animals safe until that time, if that time ever happens, that we can put them back in the wild. And I think if that happened, I don't think you see anybody really being very upset about that.
Now, just to give you an idea of some of the endangered species cared for at Beardsley, there are Ammer leopards. Now, there are only 300 Ammer leopards even remaining on Earth, and only 60 of them live in the wild. They have golden lion tamarins. Now, they're nearly extinct in the wild. One was born not too long ago in Bridgeport and was actually released in the wild back in Brazil. And the very rare red wolf. Only 20 are known to still roam the woods of eastern North Carolina. And Greg Dancho says there's a mother red wolf currently expecting babies at Connecticut Beardsley Zoo. That wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. Well, I told you I'd tell you about James Beardsley and what happened to him. Well, it turns out some criminals thought he must have a lot of money, because after all, he's donating all this land to the city of Bridgeport and money to develop the park. So they broke into his house the day before Christmas Eve 1892. He told them he had no money, and he didn't, because he had spent his fortune on developing the park. Well, they beat him, and he died a week later of his injuries, and the robbers escaped with $60. They were never caught. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Greg Dancho, longtime director of Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo. The answer to this week's trivia question, the question was, this Connecticut resident wrote one of the most famous books ever, and not accidentally led the way to bringing copyright law to the U.S. to protect such writings. Who was he? The answer? Noah Webster. And his famous book, of course, was the first American dictionary, which we now all know as the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. We'll tell you how that came about. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, we'll take a look at the unbelievably important life that Noah Webster led. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe and stay healthy.